Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Ben. Join me as I chat with big thinkers, decision makers, and leaders in the world of tech. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we are joined by Alex Toya, who's lead front-end developer at Yubota. Really good to have you join us today, Alex. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
It's a pleasure. Yeah. So I think to get the ball rolling, you know, for the listeners' sake, you know, before we get into the depths of the conversation, could you give us a bit of insight into Yubota and where it, what it is and where you fit into the world of tech?
Definitely can do. The short version of it is Yubota is a London-based technology company. We've been founded in 2016. And what we've done over the last 3.5 to 4 years is basically build a fast, flexible, cloud-native core banking platform. This platform allows our clients to create and run innovative financial products. And by financial products, it basically allows them to get to market with financial product ideas, such as particular types of loans or deposit accounts or other type of banking services fairly quickly, which is a thing that is sorely missed at the moment in the industry, especially in some of the sectors like banking, finance, insurance, because they're older industries that tend to move a bit slower. What we're trying to make sure is our platform lets our clients to just take it, configure what they need, and then brand it the way they want it and access the market.
Yeah, cool. Sounds interesting. So, I mean, lead front-end developer, a lot of people know what that is, but it can kind of vary between different role in different industries, sectors, and markets. So what's that role like at Yubota? What does that entail?
I mean, to be honest, just saying lead front-end developer would be a bit misleading at this point in time, because obviously, as it is with software over time, the role has evolved. Initially, when I started, we had a very small front-end team. What we had to do and what my personal responsibilities were to take some older projects that we had and convert them to something a bit more modern. I believe we were using a very standard way of doing things a few years ago, which was a monolith application, so everything was clumped into one place. But the first task I had as lead front-end developer was to basically build a team and make sure we transition this into something a bit more modern, using a dedicated front-end application, a back-end API, and sort of the entire conversion of the system from a monolith to API front-end lead. Over time, obviously, because when we started converting and working on the apps, we've obviously had to interact with a lot of the parts of the system that we have, including everything we had on the back end, the database, the data structures and stuff. The role has evolved a bit into something which is sort of closer to what you'd call a technical architect overall, because initially we built the app, but then after we finished that project, we started looking at and how we can improve it, how we can improve our system overall. And a lot of those were driven from a user perspective, just because we've come to a point where we realized if we want to have a proper application and give it to users, it needs to look the part and behave the part. We can't just give them 20 fields in a form and expect them to be happy with that. If we know we can improve on that and make it easier to work with. And especially since our company is mostly it's marketing to other businesses, which are our clients, which are the banks using our platform, we need to make sure that they have what they need to perform their entire operations and
Excellent. I mean, so that sounds like there's a lot of innovations being made. And so how long, when did you start this role? When did you join Yubota?
It feels like a very long time ago. I think it's actually been about 2.5 years. Obviously, over the last 9 months have just flown by, so I stopped counting in about May. But I think I've started 2.5 years ago. Yeah, I've been there ever since. As I mentioned, the role has evolved over time. That is one thing that I really like about the company is is the fact that they allow us to sort of grow and develop inside the company. So a lot of the times, these are mostly stories I've heard from other people. You get into a role, you stay there for 3 years, there's nothing, you can't go up, you can't go down, you're just doing a job every day. While at Yobora, we're sort of trying to get people to express their ideas, express what they want to do, because a lot of the times you don't really have someone who can tell you, I know how this is done, this is the only way. It's always a continuous improvement process that we're doing. So
yeah, and then also you've been there 2.5 years, but it's, by the sounds of it, you're making a lot of changes. I mean, what always surprises me is how fast tech moves. Like, obviously,
yes,
it moves really, really quick. Everybody knows how quickly it moves, but
yeah, it does.
Doing these podcasts made me realize just how quick and the scale of the changes are so dramatic.
Changes that are needed. Yeah, it's I would say, especially from a front-end perspective, where you have 5 new frameworks, which are the future, show up every year on a constant basis.
Yeah.
It is something we've had to sort of keep in mind and deal with it. The way we're managing this process of technology advancing and us being able to stay up to date with it is always considering, we've taken this approach of developing user first, if that makes sense. So in terms of, we always think of the problem in terms of what's needed for our platform to achieve or for this feature to achieve, not necessarily this is how we're gonna build it and then we're gonna think about the user later. We're starting from a user perspective, and that allows us to kind of have a top-down view on what components need to be created, both on like front and back end database and so on, which lets us, I'd say, adapt fairly quickly in case there are changes. Obviously, we're also trying to do everything, and I know this word is used by everyone with different meanings, but in a fairly agile way. So we never have a 6 months project that 3 devs are working on in a corner and nobody knows about it. It's always reviews every week, every 2 weeks on progress. And that kind of, if we find a different way or somebody has a better idea of how to do it, we just get on it as quickly as we can. And that has sort of allowed us to stay up to date with pretty much everything that we're using in terms of our tech stack.
You're adapting for the user perspective. So how do you know what changes need to be made? Because I've realized, speaking to a lot of people in tech, they often kind of say people like kind of make changes, but they don't need to be made at all. They're not issues, they're not problems, and they're just making changes for the sake of it. So how do you decide what developments you need to make?
So that part is where the sort of technical architect part of the role comes in. We do try to keep everything up to date in terms of, if we use a particular technology, we don't let the versions to become obsolete or have like security issues in them as well. The bits that we improve, obviously nothing is perfect the first time you build it. And if anybody says it's perfect the first time, they're lying. I will never believe that. And the way we do it is whenever we always have a list of things that we can improve on. And as we pick those things up, we'll see, does it make sense to use this new thing here or not? If it does, then we will do the work required to make that software or package or feature available at that point in time. And generally speaking, we do also work on the assumption that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But whenever we get to a point where a thing is at the bottom of the list and needs either a facelift, at least from a front-end perspective, either a facelift or an improvement, or performance is getting slower compared to what's needed, we'll always evaluate at that point, do we need to do something in terms of the tech we're using?
Excellent.
To make this faster, to make this nicer for the user.
Cool. Very good. So from a technical stance, what... Mm-hmm. What specific innovations are you working on at Yobora, and what makes you different from other businesses, would you say?
So that is sort of a more complicated question to say. So if you look from the outside world, if you just look at the tech stack, it's the standard front and back end database stack. I think what makes us different in terms of the rest of the industry at the moment is the fact that this stack has been built working closely with our clients. So a lot of the, and especially in banking, which is a very highly regulated industry, and in fintech in general, we have hit all of the, a lot of those blockers that would stop other companies from proceeding. And we've basically adapted to either include the regulation that we need to. So it's not necessarily we've developed a new coding language or we've developed a new framework. It's mostly we've built our system to have everything it needs without further blockers from a client perspective. I would say one of the things we're doing, which I think is extremely, it's extremely innovative, at least from my, from what I've seen so far in terms of finance and banking. On top of our platform, we've also created a system that allows us to simulate the platform behavior over time. This, obviously, we're not very good at naming, so we're calling it the simulator because it simulates things. But what this allows us to do is it allows us to give it some parameters, start it running, and what it will do will basically simulate the system's interaction, both internal and external, over a given period of time. So if you think of it currently, if you work in a big bank and you want to test your transactions module or something, somebody has to go in, put some money, wait for a day for the money to be transferred, and then check it on the other side. What we're doing, we're basically encapsulating the whole system. We're rolling the time forward. All the system functions will perform, and you get the results that you expect or you don't expect in literally like 10, 15 minutes.
Wow.
Which is sounds very interesting just based on this, but what we're also using it to do is simulate entire products and how they behave over time. Just to expand on this, one of the modules that we have in our platform allows clients to set up loans and offer those loans online by either third party, you know, those comparison websites, or directly through the website. Now, when the customer, client actually creates the product, they have to make some decisions in terms of what rates they offer, for what credit scores they offer the product, and so on. And what we can do with the simulator is basically say, okay, so we have this product that has been defined. Can you show me how this behaves over 2 years of lifetime in the future, given this user distribution? So that basically lets them get a pretty good idea of how the financials of a product evolve over time as well. Not just that, you know, how the portfolio grows, what happens if, for example, there's a, in terms of risk management, there's a financial crisis and suddenly 20% of the people who took this product can no longer pay it. And that kind of gives them the overview at the end, what's going to happen from a bank's perspective.
Banking is a very traditional industry. So, and obviously there's modern technologies coming out left, yeah, right and center. So how do you use that, those technologies? And by the sound of things, it's a lot of it is to do with speed. So, yes, I
would say one thing in terms of, because there's been a lot of improvement lately because of the whole fintech revolution, as people call it. Yep. So some of the older banks have started adopting newer technologies as well, but they're fairly slow. I would say it's not always necessarily outdated technology, but sometimes there are some legal constraints that technology providers need to be aware of. Obviously, if you're lending out money or taking deposits, there are some constraints on how much you can take, how much you can guarantee for, and stuff like this. I would say the reason we're able to develop so fast is because us at Yobota, we consider ourselves a technology company. We are not a bank. We do not have a banking license ourselves. So because we're a technology company, in terms of development, we're also allowed to focus a lot more on agile methodology, as I was mentioning earlier, not necessarily like, here, go do this project for 12 months and then we'll see if we put it out or not. So pretty much every little thing that we build into the system is useful to someone. we're also taking the approach that we should do testing as soon as possible.
Right.
So we do testing as well as like development in small increments, because a lot of the times you might see something in your mind as an idea and you start working on it, and based on either user testing or internal testing, you realize 2 weeks in that it's not necessarily going to work. And what would happen in the big bang, you'd finish the project after 6 months and then it will get canned because it didn't work. But for us, it just allows us to sort of switch approaches fairly quickly. And the also being able to test the entire platform behavior using that tool that we've built, which allows us to travel through time, basically. That's how we say it. It gives us sort of confirmation that what we're doing is valid and is correct, and it allows us to move, I'd say, a lot quicker than most of the industry at the moment. So that would be one. And the other one is, in terms of the way we've conceived the system, everything is fairly modular and isolated. So we can work on various products that we offer on the way they interact without being afraid of knocking over something else in the system. So it's an architectural advantage. We don't have a big mainframe, which if mainframe goes down, everything goes down. Everything is sort of modular. It's built for purpose. It's not a generic thing that covers everything somebody can think about, and that allows us to move fairly quickly through.
Excellent. Is there a need or an importance to be constantly improving the software? And what advice would you give to people who are looking to do that? Obviously, we've been speaking about how fast developments are.
I would say it is indeed. The main reason is I've run into this. Probably many developers have run into this over their careers. Whereas you start a new job, you're really excited about the job, and then you see the code base and you see last update 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And at that point, your entire world crashes down and you're like, okay, is there anyone in this company who still knows what's going on here? And most of the times the answer is nope.
Yep.
So in terms of this, that's why I personally believe it's important to constantly improve and not have those repositories which are 2.5 years old, unupdated, last edited by some random GitHub username that doesn't exist anymore, and nobody knows what they do. So in terms of improvement, it's a lot of the times it's not major things I need to be doing. It's maybe updating a few packages, making sure it, like refactoring some code if it needs refactoring, creating additional tests whenever you have issues with particular piece of code, not necessarily just dropping in a fix and just leaving it there and never touching it again. And I would say also another thing that I consider personally software improvements, which I do with my guys, is make sure your code is documented, so that in case it gets to that situation where the repo hasn't been touched for 2.5 years, somebody can come in and at least figure out what a particular service does, or, you know.
How do you approach projects with the end user in mind?
I would say initially, you always have to think of the product from the user's perspective in terms of what will the system be used for, who is going to use it, why are they going to use it, and what they want to get out of it. Initially, first thing we usually do is try to identify the target users of the product and the context they will use it in. Obviously, for us, our target users are banks, which want to launch financial products to the market. And the context is they want to be able to go into the system, configure what they need, and then push it out to the market. After this point, so after we've sort of defined the context, we do some market research and user interviews. But again, in order to do this, it's very important to know what the user needs are first. But we're always looking out at the industry and what it is, because obviously we don't really like reinventing the wheel. And in general, you can always look if there's something similar to what you're trying to do out there, and then not saying use that if it doesn't necessarily fit the purpose, but see what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong before you get started in terms of, like, don't build the system and try to fix it after. Think ahead and then build based on that. After that, I'd say you need to create some user personas. So based on this research that we've done in the previous step, we create the user personas that emphasize the needs of the users. So for example, let's just say you have a card app that we're developing. We're not at the moment, but for example purposes. So what is your user persona? What are your user personas for that? So first of all, you have the user personas on the bank side, which are the account managers for that particular person. So you say, okay, so we have someone who's very senior in a bank. Their role is to make sure that, you know, the interactions with the card companies are okay, the transactions are going through correctly. You also have the banks, let's say developers, that build the actual app. And for them, the purpose of the tool is not necessarily to tell them if the transactions go right, but it's to make sure that we notify them so they can put a push notification in their mobile app. So that's on one side. And the other side, you have the customer, which basically gets a card. He needs to sign up. Some people sign up. They're very happy signing up online with a face ID or anything like that. Some people prefer to do it via post. So again, it's you split all the user categories that you can think of. And then after we have those, we'll create some wireframes, some prototypes. This is still before we actually start coding. So we'll do the wireframes, we'll do the prototypes. We'll circulate them internally in the company to make sure that is something that we can achieve in a reasonable time frame. And then we do some mock-ups based on the wireframes, which would illustrate the final product. But the mock-ups, the way we build the mock-ups, they are fairly interactive. Obviously, data doesn't go anywhere, but you can still put in something in your form and it will give you an error if it's not an email address. One thing I would say is very important at this point is to try and allow for some flexibility in your implementation, because during this process of doing the wireframes, either you as someone who's leading a project or the company as a whole, they might realize, oh, there is a situation, there's a part of the market we haven't thought of. And we've just realized this because, let's say, I'm trying to apply for a loan and I have a low credit score. So when I'm actually clicking through the app and there's an option that says, what's your credit score? And you say one, that wouldn't be the same as someone with, like, let's say 900 on a particular scale. There's about five of them floating around at the moment. But it's always, and if you allow that flexibility, you might find things that you didn't think of to begin with. And then we do, based on those, we finish up, we wrap up the prototypes. We do usability testing, either that or we do some focus groups, interviews, A/B testing, depending on sort of what the project is about. And once we're happy with what we have at the end of the test result, that's when we actually start development. So we try to make sure, you know, the classic, I was going to say measure once, cut twice, but the classic measure twice, cut once. Because it's a lot easier to change a design prototype, at least from a front-end perspective, than to build three screens and have to discard them because they're not fit for purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
And especially like in a smaller company, and that is particularly important in a smaller company, and startups, I'd say probably under 200 people, there's not a lot of time that you can waste trying things without affecting the business as a whole. So it's better to have everything, to have a very good idea of what you need to build before you start building it.
Is there anything you feel is underestimated in the industry?
I would say so, at least from a let's talk about financial industry and banking, and mainly the bit that I focus on a lot, which is the not necessarily the customer facing one, which is you have a lot of great apps like Mons Revolut, which are amazing from that perspective. But I'm talking about more of the statistics reporting, internal use of systems. I think like core banking solutions, they don't necessarily have user-friendly approaches for their staff and for their members. Despite having fancy-looking customer solutions like amazing apps, great notification, great user service through the apps, support centers, and everything else, the internal culture of the company, which is the people who are actually managing the system, is negatively impacted, and there's a lack of focus on human-centered solutions. Most of the time, people just have to download the data, put it in a spreadsheet, edit it, and upload it again. Why can't that be done in an app which has the same sort of the same design and the same ideology as the one that the customer uses? Obviously, being an internal tool is not as important as the external ones, but at least they can try. And I would also say, based on what I've seen in various places, especially when it comes to like mortgage brokering app applications and stuff like this, a lot of banking systems just have a massive overload of functionality, which many times, instead of just helping bank employees, it just gets them more confused. And then that basically also leads in, if they're going to have to use these tools, they have to spend weeks and months learning how to use it. And then when the system changes a little bit, you get that resistance to change because they've spent so much time learning something that if you make a change from one system to another, then it's basically, they know it's going to be another 6 months of learning this and then another. And I think, to be honest, I think that might be one of the main reasons why there's such a massive resistance to change in some industry. Is you're using a tool which is so very complicated, but you're proficient in it. And then some young startup comes and tells you, no, you got to forget everything. You got to use this other tool, which is equally as complicated, let's say. And then there's a lot of resistance, especially from like management and senior teams who say like, we don't have time. Our time is more precious doing what we do than adapting to this change. And that's why I think like change management is an industry in its own. And obviously like whenever you're developing an app, there's a few, like three points that are always at the top of the list, which is have a well-structured navigation, make sure that the data you display is actually actionable and you're not displaying something that's useless. And just keep the layout as simple and as visually appealing as it needs to be. It doesn't mean that you can't display a table with a lot of information, but if the user is looking for the first three or four columns, why not hide the rest and then just allow them to query for them when they need to? It's not a spreadsheet simulator. It's not for a purpose. So at that point is try and see what they use, because a lot of times people will say, oh, we need this, we need that, we need that. But when you actually do the user research, they never use that data. They never click on it. They never even look at it. So you can hide it from the screen, say that it's there, and they'll never realize that it's not there. And that, again, comes back to making sure you do your user research properly, because and having good designers, I would say that is also very important. Having people who are very good at UI, UX design is, I'd say, is crucial, especially in like this day and age where everything needs to be snappy, everything needs to work fast. Like, gone are the days where you can wait for 5 minutes for your modem to connect to download something.
Yeah. You make it sound so simple, Alex. I'm sure it's far more complicated. I mean, it's crazy because obviously you've just put it down to like a few bullet points that people need to make sure that they do in like a particular order. And it's crazy that there'll be a lot of people that overlook a lot of those things. It's madness.
Let's just say I've been burnt by those 3 points enough time that at this point I know where to start from and where it needs to go. Because, I mean, I'm not saying this is the golden rule for everything, but from what I've seen so far, if you don't do these 3 things, eventually you'll get in a place where your product is outdated in half a year. Or people complain that they don't like it. So,
you know, obviously you've been in the industry for a fair few years now. And this is an interesting question because everyone seems to have some kind of different area where they look to for resources. I mean, you've got people who are avid listeners to podcasts. Some people troll YouTube, some people on Twitter even, and there's loads of different areas where people look for inspiration just to stay ahead of the curve. So where do you look for resources?
Well, I would say it's a bit of a mix of all of the above. I mean, obviously Medium is a great place for like reading about new technologies, and even if it's something that you're not necessarily, you know, you're not going to use because it's not fit for purpose, it gives you a bit of awareness on what's going on. I would say another important point is whenever people are building something that's new, and they can afford to experiment with things, just go out there and experiment with it. Especially when we're talking about technologies like JavaScript, we're looking Angular, Vue, React, all the subcategories for each of them. And it's okay, so I have a project which needs to display a calendar. Why not try to use this way of loading data? So for example, why not try GraphQL instead of an API? And that's how you learn, because you'll get into it, you'll see it's useful, you'll realize hopefully that you have no idea how it works and what it does, and then you go and read more. And it's basically just try and focus on one thing at a time. I would say the amount of new things is overwhelming, but find something, learn it, and then move on to the next one. And also very important, I would say, this in terms of staying up to date, is use what you learn about. Don't just learn about it because you've learned about something new. You go somewhere, you don't work with it, you don't touch that, don't touch it, don't read about it for 2 months, and then it's gone because you've read an article and that's about it. Well, if you go home and let's make a to-do list using this thing instead of that thing, then it's a lot easier for it to stick. And I think keeping up to date with technology is also developing the ability to sort of know what needs to be used when, and not just I know 20 frameworks. Because if you know 20 frameworks, wherever you go to work, you're not going to be able to use all 20 of them. You'll use one. Right, so I'd rather you know one with all the advancements on that and stay up to date with that than knowing 20. And knowing a particular technology well enough also kind of gives you the ability to switch from a framework to another fairly easily. That is also...
So would you say it's... Say if you were starting out in your career and you're looking to, you know, get into the industry, would you say it's better to have a blanket knowledge of all, kind of a lot of the different, you know, softwares, or just one that you know incredibly well?
So I would say from my perspective and the way I look, at least from front end, I'm not talking back end because that's a bit different. I would say you need to be aware of what exists out there. Be decent at one of them, because I feel it's come to a point where most of the innovation is mostly iterative on things that already exist. So there's a lot of similarities between different frameworks. They do things differently in the background, but at the same time, the core concepts are the same, at least from a development perspective. If you know the core concepts for one of them, then it will take you basically a week of reading documentation to be at the same level in a different framework. Well, if you just know what it does for 20 of them and you can't really code in anyone particular, then it's going to take more than a week of reading docs to switch over. So it's always be aware of what's going on, but focus on, it's not a great word at the moment, I'd say specialize on something, because being specialized on something gets you to a point where you start thinking about what you're doing, not necessarily lines of code, but in terms of concepts, in terms of approach, in terms of and I think from a developer perspective in most companies, and especially in small companies, that gives you a lot of opportunity to advance yourself as both career-wise and as a developer.
Absolutely, that's great advice. So I'm thinking back. So if you think back to when you first started in your career, is there anything that you wish you'd have found out or been told at the start that you've had to go on and learn the hard way?
There are a few things, but I think the most important one, when I started, I was working as a sort of freelancer consulting sort of gig. And the one thing that I wish I knew was that people are stubborn. You can have the most amazing system, if you cannot convince someone of the benefits of it, they just don't care. Like they do not. And you need to go into any type of role with that impression. I would say when I started, like as a young developer, I was like, oh, I'm going to go in there and change everything and everything's going to be great because I dreamt about it last night and it's going to be amazing and I'm the greatest. And then 2 weeks later, I'm like, okay, maybe I need to start listening to people.
Yeah.
Because even if you don't necessarily agree with something, it is there for a reason most of the times. It's not like, so I would say, people are stubborn and don't expect to change everything from the start, because I know it's exciting to begin with, but it's, world doesn't work that way, sadly.
Definitely. So would you say that was your main point of advice then? I mean, what do you say to people who come to you and they go, how do we get into the industry?
How I managed to get in the industry was be lucky enough to do a good technical interview and do a good face-to-face interview with a company working in the industry, which was most at that point, and even now, to be honest, we're looking for people who fit the company, not what they necessarily have on their CV. So if their attitude is correct, if their knowledge is good, then we'll usually get them into the company and then train them in those areas of the industry that are a bit more obscure, a bit more complicated. So I think based on this, the advice would be just apply and then find a company that actually is willing to upskill you. Because if you look at it, sure, people see those massive emails from recruiters with massive salaries, like you just look at them and you're like, oh my God. And then you actually realize that in order to get there, you need to have been there for 5 years already.
Yeah.
So I would say start with a company that's willing to train you up in a particular industry. And that can be anything, that can be banking, that can be retail. If you're also young enough to do it, industrial placements and internships are also a great place to start, because you build up some knowledge and then when you're done with your studies or whatever you're doing, you go back there. I'd always say start small and just let it learn as you go along. I'd say that's the most important thing, like try and learn as much as you can.
You've given us some amazing advice for pretty much anyone in the industry. I mean, amazing. I've come here for a sausage roll and you give me a buffet.
And you've got a beef Wellington.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.